It's Sam Cedar launching an illegal invasion and occupation of your brain.
This episode of the Majority Report is brought to you by Audible.com. You can get a free audiobook of your choice. Go to audiblepodcast.com/majority report. That's audiblepodcast.com/majority report for a free audiobook.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. It's time to look in the mirror, America. Do you like what you see?
I keep referring to Obama as the magic Negro.
Do you like what you see now?
Well, suck on this.
It's just a mirror, America.
Shared sacrifice by everybody.
What could it do to you except reflect your image?
I did nothing wrong at the Minneapolis airport.
The Majority Report.
Far more credible to me than PBS
and Frontline.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
If I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Tuesday, June 19th, 2012. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live in the literal, though not metaphorical, shadow of the New York Times building in the fashionable Dollar Lunch District of New York City. Great program for you today. Two, count them, two interviews from Netroots Nation. First, Bill McKibben of 350.org on the current state of the environmental fights, particularly against global warming, and the future of environmental direct action. Listen to his interview carefully. Next up after that, Dave Zirin from edgeofsports.com, Nation writer who writes of sports in a political context. Also a fascinating interview, if I do say so myself. And more on the program today, Chris Christie. Whoops. It just seems like a guy can't get a break. You function as a lobbyist for companies that privatize government services and screw up royally. Sometimes that comes to bite you back, to bite you in the butt. And Chris Christie will not be Mitt Romney's VP pick. We'll talk more about that. Google releases its list of which countries ask for user data, and pull downs of videos. Are you going to be shocked as to who's number one? The Consumer Financial Protection Bureau launches its complaint database. Banks whine. Trinity Church successful in prosecuting a Vietnam War hero and a member of the clergy for stepping on their property, which is actually very difficult not to do in this city, apparently. Representative Bob Turner of New York, picking up on the age-old tradition of Republicans using children in the most exploitive and pathetic manners. Also some stories out of Israel. Those crazy, lovable, extremist settlers doing one of those crazy, lovable acts of burning down a mosque. Isn't that lovely? We'll talk about that. The Republicans still in a tizzy, don't know what to do about President Obama's executive order, basically not punishing young children for the actions of their parents if those young children behave better than 95% of the rest of the children in this country. And the UN looking at drone strikes, particularly ours. But as Glenn Greenwald tweeted, you know, listening to the UN was so 2004, 2003. You know, the whole idea about Saddam Hussein breaking resolutions. That's old news. But first, this interview with Bill McKibben of 350.org. I caught up with him at Netroots Nation 2012. Here it is now. I am at Netroots Nation 2012 in Providence, Rhode Island. And with me is Bill McKibben from 350.org. Bill, first off, you know, this was a 2012 and or I guess really the past year has been quite a, maybe year and a half now, I guess, quite a year and a half for the environmental movement. There has been increasing, I don't want to say militancy, but increasing aggressive direct action. Starting with Tim DeChristopher, and who was the environmental activist who went into a mining auction or a land lease, federal land lease auction, and bid up the prices for an auction that was invalid for other reasons anyway, and ended up getting 2 years in prison, which is a stunning amount of time to be in prison.
And let me just say, I got to go visit Tim out in prison about a month ago, and he's doing really well and really strong and about to have his appeals. Even if he doesn't get win the appeal, he'll be on the loose by Christmas time or thereabouts, I think, and we cannot wait to get him back on the outside.
He really is an incredibly admirable figure. I mean, genuinely admirable.
He is a good man.
He, does a little bit of a tangent, but he also rejected money for his own defense fund by a corporation or a company that was outsourcing American jobs. Now, I want to sort of circle back to this in a minute, because that is not an environmental concern. But he is in prison for environmental activism. Let's start there, actually. Talk to me about the idea of this environmental activist being so concerned about the idea of jobs for America, of an issue that is has traditionally been in a different issue silo.
I think we're starting to realize that there aren't really different issue silos. It's exactly the same people that we're fighting on every front. So, for instance, we've just come through this disastrous election in Wisconsin. Why did we lose? One reason was that the Koch brothers poured an insane amount of money, I mean, and I'm talking insane amount of money, into that state. Where did the Koch brothers get their money? Well, by gum, what do you know? They're deep, deep, deep in the tar sands of Canada, the place where this pipeline is supposed to come south that we've been fighting for the last year, a pipeline that'll deliver endless amounts of carbon to the atmosphere and endless amounts of money into the pockets of the Koch brothers, which they'll use to take aim at our union brothers and sisters and at everything else that's, you know, right and proper in this world.
We're talking about Keystone XL. And but from a tactical standpoint, I mean, because then and we had spoken on this program and on my other program around the time of Tim DeChristopher's sentencing, I believe it was. And you had suggested to me, and I think that was probably about a year and a half ago, in March or February of last year, that we're going to see more direct action by environmentalists. And then over the course of the summer, late summer, you organized about 1,500 to 2,000 activists who were willing to get arrested in Washington. Just remind us of
yes,
that.
Yes, we actually, somewhat to my surprise, since I may, I may have talked a good game when I was talking with you, but I've never actually organized something quite like this. Working with a lot of other people, we put together what turned into the largest civil disobedience action in 30 years in America. 1,253 people arrested over 2 weeks outside the White House, that took an issue, this Keystone Pipeline, that frankly almost no one had heard of a year ago, and made it into a national issue. In fact, such a national issue that Mitt Romney, in his first TV commercial of the general election last week, said, "My first task in my first hour in the White House will be to approve the Keystone Pipeline." So, you know, for better or for worse, we at least showed you can take an issue no one's ever heard of and put it someplace close to the middle of the national agenda, not with money, but with our bodies.
And there was at least a short-term victory on that accord.
Temporary victories are, you know, the only kind that environmentalists win. This one may be more temporary than most. The president did a pretty brave thing. He said, "We're going to delay consideration of this pipeline for a year to take a closer look at it." He did it in the face of the American Petroleum Institute, a.k.a. Big Oil, saying, "We will make you pay huge political consequences," quote unquote. They're doing all that they can. I mean, that Romney ad's part of it. So are the hundreds of millions of dollars that various fossil fuel tycoons are pouring into the campaign against the president. Now, I got to be honest with you. The president's done some other things that aren't as brave, and we've been busily opening up the Powder River Basin to coal mining and the Arctic to oil drilling and things like that. But at least in this case, where citizens actually managed to get their act together to stand up and say what was what, we had an administration that was willing to listen.
You know, I want to get your take on this, because there's a lot of conversation that is taking place at Netroots. There's a lot of conversations that are taking place across the board following Wisconsin, which I don't think provided anything new to the conversation, but it made everything a little bit more urgent. And that is, how do we get more? How can people, via their bodies, via their actions, their protest actions, get more responsiveness out of the administration? And many people have turned to the marriage equality model that we've seen much more of that. But I actually think that Keystone, the actions that you've taken at Keystone, are far more applicable. I want to get your sense of this, because at the end of the day, marriage equality does not have big economic implications outside of for those people who are going to have that equality. It has big issues if you're a married couple and you're not getting the same rights as another married couple. That has big financial issues.
But there's not big money in bigotry in this case.
No, yeah. And I think that's why that analogy has not been as apt. But the idea that you could get President Obama, even if only briefly, to buck up against huge and powerful economic forces seems to me to be, at least there's something prescriptive there.
So, Sam, there's two things here. Yeah, one, that's true. It was remarkable to be able to get the president and the administration to realize that we were as serious as the oil industry was, okay? The second thing, however, is I think what I've learned as much as anything else is we're not going to do this fight against climate change in the end one pipeline at a time. We're going to have to figure out how to get behind the politicians and actually at the fossil fuel industry, because that's where the money and the influence is coming from. That's why this summer at 350 we're doing this big campaign.
Let's take a break.
Yeah,
I want
sure.
to take a break here, and
all
when
right.
we come back, I want to talk about how it is that we can sort of have a more global response
Absolutely.
To what is, a, in
how
fact,
we, how we
literally
actually kick the fossil fuel industry in the nuts if we possibly can. Yeah,
so to speak.
Yeah.
All right.
No,
we're
actually,
take a,
literally.
So to speak. Well, and we're going to take a break. We'll be right back with more from Bill McKibben.
Everybody's coming home for lunch these days. Last night there were skinheads
Hello, person who is listening to the Majority Report. This episode of the Majority Report is brought to you by Audible.com, the internet's leading provider of audiobooks, with more than 100,000 downloadable titles across all types of literature and featuring audio versions of many New York Times bestsellers. You enjoying this interview with Bill McKibben? Well, pick up his audiobook, Earth, Making a Life on a Tough New Planet, for free. That's right. Get a free Audible version of that book at audiblepodcast.com/majority report. That's audiblepodcast.com/majority report. You can pick up a free version of an audio book, in this case, Bill McKibben's, right now.
Some people say that bowling alley's got big lanes.
Got big lanes. Got big lanes.
Some people say that bowling alleys all look the same. There's not a line that goes here that rhymes with anything.
Anything, anything.
Had a dream last night, but I forget what it was.
What it was, what it was.
Take the skinheads bowling, take them bowling.
We are back. I am talking to Bill McKibben of 350.org. We are at Netroots Nation 2012. And when we broke, Bill, we were talking about the realization that you and others have had in the environmental movement, that you cannot, to quote you from just our last segment, you cannot fight global warming and its implications one pipeline at a time, that you must go directly towards the source of the problem. Because in some ways, these pipelines are symptoms.
Yes, and there's too many of them. We don't have enough fingers to stick in all the possible dikes, you know, in this case. So the fight is to get at that incredible special privilege that the fossil fuel industry enjoys, the only industry in the world that's allowed to just throw its waste out for free, okay? That's the biggest subsidy that they have, that they can pour their carbon into the atmosphere and wreck the climate without paying a price. But this summer, what we're working on is a kind of prelude to that, a kind of appetizer, is the direct subsidies that these guys get. Bernie Sanders, my senator, introduced a bill last week along with Keith Ellison from Minnesota in the House that will remove $113 billion in direct federal subsidy to the fossil fuel industry over the next decade. Now, to make that happen, we're trying to put together for the first time a kind of really technologically empowered citizenry. We've just launched this scoreboard at 350.org where anybody can go up to their senator or congressman, say, are you in favor of fossil fuel subsidies? They can take 20 seconds of iPhone photo and upload it to this scoreboard. And we're going to, by the time the election comes around, have pinned everybody down. Because you know what? Nobody, not Republicans, not independents, like not Democrats, think that there's any reason to be handing over billions of dollars to Exxon. Even if you like Exxon, they clearly don't need the money, you know? And we're clearly not subsidizing anything because we learned how to burn coal 300 years ago.
Right.
This is like, you know, giving someone a scholarship.
This is not a nascent technology.
It's like giving someone a scholarship to go to college for the 29th time, you know?
Right.
It's like, guys, after a certain point, you got to pay for it yourselves, you know?
Well, so now this is interesting because that model reminds me of the one that was organized, the Talking Points memo in 2005, when they were fighting the privatization of Social Security, basically crowdsourcing individuals across the country and putting their representative on record and pinning them down and saying, answer this question, where are you going to be? Because it prevents them from being able to sort of dodge that question
and
get buried in a voice vote somewhere.
And you know what? If they're not willing to do it, we're going to do our best to shame them. All these guys take money from the fossil fuel industry. If you do that, you should be proud of it. You should be like the NASCAR drivers who wear their allegiance literally on their sleeve. We've got people doctoring up a couple of hundred blue blazers with all the logos of people's sponsors, and we're going to be handing them out. You should go on the floor of the Senate. If you're going to argue for giving people's hard-earned money over to Exxon, you should go on the Senate and say, well, you know what, I need to do this because Exxon's giving me money.
Now, after you go after the direct subsidies, how do you then go after the tougher nut to crack, which is to make people understand that we are subsidizing them every time you take your kid down because they've got asthma. We're subsidizing them every time there's a drought somewhere, or as the climate is.
I'm going to be secretive with you. We've got a plan, and it unveils the day after the election, literally the night after. Naomi Klein and I and a few others have been hard at work, and we're going to do our best to rock the world of the fossil fuel industry. For the moment, we're going to concentrate through the election on getting rid of these direct subsidies and really making it clear just how complicit the political class is with this kind of outright corruption.
All right. Well, let's make an agreement to make sure that we're talking the day after the election.
The day after the election, but we're there.
Okay. And I've got that commitment. We'll put that down. Our producer has marked that in the books. But let me just briefly, how will you know, when is that point where the direct subsidies, that you will know if you've achieved that? Is that in the context of the budget or fight?
No,
or?
Hopefully we can force a vote in the House or the Senate. I don't know whether we can. In the House, maybe not. In the Senate, maybe so. To really take this on and at least get people on record so we know. What else are you going to do?
Bill McKibben, 350.org. Always a pleasure. Thanks.
Always a pleasure, brother. Take care.
There you go, ladies and gentlemen. Bill McKibben, he's got something secret in the works that we're going to see the day after the election. So we're just months away from that now. And their plans will go forward and are being made regardless of who wins the election. Because, as you know, the election is not decided yet. Now, my interview with Dave Zirin of Edge of Sports, a writer also for The Nation magazine. I think you're going to enjoy this one as well. Again, from Netroots Nation 2012.
Continuing our coverage from Netroots Nation 2012, I am joined by Dave Zirin. He is a writer for The Nation magazine. His website is edgeofsports.com. And, of course, one of my favorite writers about sports, because he always manages to tie in and writes really about how sports fits into the fabric of our society. Dave, welcome to the show.
Oh, great to be here, Sam.
All right, Dave, one of the things I want to talk about, because there's a lot of you're really good about looking at sort of the labor dynamics across sports, and also sort of the public-private investment. And sports is one of those areas where people generally think that it's divorced of political meaning, but it's not, is it?
No, and it's harder and harder to make that argument, especially just after the last 2 years. Think about everything that we've seen. You've had the lockouts in the NBA and the NFL. You have the issue of concussions in the NFL, which raises all kinds of political questions about the kind of things we enjoy to watch in our leisure time as Americans, and has a lot of people questioning that. Then there's the issue of the death of Trayvon Martin and the number of athletes who stepped up and had something to say about that, from the Miami Heat to Carmelo Anthony of the Knicks to several members of the Detroit Pistons, all speaking about why they wanted to see justice for Trayvon. And what it did for me was it reminded me that athletes have a remarkably powerful political voice. That doesn't mean that they use it all of the time, but it's something that's part of American history. There's a reason why we associate Muhammad Ali so strongly with the 60s, Jackie Robinson with the Civil Rights Movement, Billie Jean King with the Women's Liberation Movement. It's because that sports has this remarkable platform in our society. And as hyper-exalted, brought to you by Nike, as it is, when athletes choose to exercise it, it really does signal profound change.
I know we had planned to talk a little bit, to talk about and focus on the way that different municipalities and taxpayers subsidize these stadiums and the implications of that. But as I hear you talk about the concussion, I really want to talk about
sure.
that. Tell me, for those of us who don't follow sports, give us a sense of what this debate is about.
Let's start with this right here, right off the bat, Sam. The suicide rate of former NFL players is 6 times that of the typical American male.
Wow.
Think about that for a second. The average LGBT teenager, the suicide rate is twice that of the typical teenager. And that statistic is well known. So, but think about that for a second. That means a former NFL player is three times more likely to take their own life as a gay kid getting picked on as a teenager in high school. Now, what does that tell us and why is that the case? Well, it's a couple of reasons. One of the reasons is just the basic issue of adjusting with what to do with the rest of your life after having this incredibly exalted spotlight.
How does that measure to, let's say, basketball players or baseball players?
It's profoundly higher.
Okay.
And it has to, and this is where you get to the issue of concussions and violence. We now know that there's something called post-concussive damage to your brain. Now, post-concussive is an important phrase because it doesn't mean the kind of hits that you see on television, the big hits, the hits that get the big fines, helmet to helmet, laying somebody out on the turf. Post-concussive hit is as simple as banging your head. In other words, it's almost every single play for somebody who's a lineman, for example. And those hits accumulated over time lead to something that has a very long name. CTE is the abbreviation, chronic traumatic encephalopathy. And what that means in practice is things like early onset Alzheimer's disease. It means issues of depression are more likely if you have CTE, and issues of suicide, which are attendant with that. And then coupled with that, when you have CTE, concussions, all the rest of it, is the issue of painkiller addiction and what that leads to as well. So all of these things factor together to lead to a very shocking statistic, and that's that a typical NFL player will die two decades before a typical American male.
Wow.
And this is what we're watching. This is what it is, and this is what the NFL takes great pains to hide from the American viewer. Because, I mean, let's be honest. I mean, the NFL has become the biggest sport in the United States by marketing itself to families as something family-friendly. It doesn't market itself as a blood sport or gladiatorial sport or any of the rest of it. It markets itself as a family sport, and it's by far the biggest sport in this country. The number two biggest sport in this country is college football, which has an even bigger moral question, which is that in the NFL you could at least say, well, players are being compensated for this incredibly,
right,
incredibly risky life. And I personally think the NFL is best understood as a very, very dangerous workplace. That's the best way to understand it. Not as a gladiatorial contest or a plantation, which sometimes people on the left put that word on it, but as just a very, very unsafe workplace.
Right.
And compare that, though, to college, where you're not even being compensated and you get those same kinds of mild concussive hits day in, day out in practice, and the same health results as a result. A recent study in Virginia Tech said that kids as young as 7 or 8 have the same symptoms of CTE as NFL players.
Oh, God.
Because it's not about the violence and the impact. It's just about the repetitive nature of putting your head into somebody. Ironically, if they didn't wear helmets, they would be safer.
Really? Because it's the helmets that were banging in there. I understand.
Yes. And if you weren't wearing a helmet, you wouldn't lead with your head.
So what do we do with this information? All right, so, you know, this is why the NFL doesn't want people to know that, because a lot of people like to watch football every Sunday or Monday or Thursday or whatever the
right
day is now.
They're taking over every day.
But, what do we do with this information? If it's a very dangerous workplace, is it simple enough to sort of have federal legislation that says OSHA should be involved in this or what?
It's a very, very good question. I mean, there are proposals that are about fundamentally changing the game, like taking out the three-point stance, eliminating any sort of helmet-to-helmet contact on even the most mild level. I think the thing that people on the left get wrong is looking at as a prohibition issue. Like, we should be talking about banning the National Football League because of what it presents in terms of health and safety. I think a better approach is making sure that these players are as protected as possible, of supporting the NFL Players Association, of making sure that players have health care for more than 5 years after they retire. They get kicked off their health care.
Is there better technology that could ever deal with this? I mean, better helmet technology?
See, this is where you get to the Freakonomics thing. You see, there are concussions in other sports, like hockey has a terrible concussion problem. Girls lacrosse has the highest concussion problem of any sport. Competitive cheerleading has more examples of paralysis and catastrophic injury than the NFL. There are other dangerous sports, but these other sports, you could imagine regulation and rule changes that would make the sports safer. And when it comes to football, it is so built into the very nature of the beast. And I think the main reason the NFL wants to hide this from us is not because they fear prohibition or banning, and this is what I think is the more likely future for the NFL, is that it'll become like boxing. I mean, there was a time when boxing was the most popular sport in the United
right.
States. and it's not anymore. Max Kellerman, who's a very good boxing commentator, was asked where the next great U.S. heavyweight champion was going to come from, and he said, oh, he's playing middle linebacker. And it's because parents don't have their kids doing that anymore. And I think this past year, they just came out with the numbers, a million less kids are playing football at the youth level than a year ago. That's a year. A million kids less.
Is that, did you control for any reduction in population?
I don't know about reduction of population at all. And no one has the exact sort of
right.
data about this,
but
the suspicion
clearly,
is it's not a coincidence
right.
with Junior Seau's suicide and all the knowledge about concussions.
Interesting.
About parents just saying, take him out. And I got to speak anecdotally about this. I mean, my own life, my father-in-law was drafted by the Dallas Cowboys. It was always seen as something that just would happen, that my son would play football. That's not happening anymore. My wife has stepped in and said, it ain't happening. And given what I know about it, I'm not arguing with her.
Fascinating.
And from talking to other parents, that's a very similar discussion that's happening.
Wow, that's interesting. Because, you know, I know for our daughter, we're saying no gymnastics. Because
that's
I just know
smart.
Too many, I know too many people, women whose backs are just destroyed by doing gymnastics. For
the
five
better
years
she ago. Is, the better your daughter would have been at gymnastics, the worse her life would have been after the age of 35. And that's so screwed up if you think about it, because people who are athletes should be the healthiest people in our society.
Right.
By any sane measure. And instead, we've developed this weird world where most of us just watch and get very unhealthy because we don't move. And then the people who play are also very unhealthy.
This represents, I mean, it's an interesting dilemma because, as you mentioned it, you know, you see it as a dangerous workplace situation. But for a lot of these guys,
yes.
This, and, you know, that's why you see these guys also play college football.
Yeah.
Is this notion of this is the my one ticket.
Yes.
And it's like, you know, I'm a coal miner. I live in West Virginia. And
this is what
I'm
going to
be
do.
There's well, it's also I don't have many other options.
Right.
And so this is what I got to do. This is what I know. And they go ahead for it, even if it's a dangerous situation. So this is one of those situations where society has to step in some ways to prevent the implications of this dynamic.
And this is what makes it such a dynamite TNT kind of an issue, because it raises this question of what it means to have freedom of choice in America. Because it's like you don't want to limit the choice of people to be able to play football if they want to play, but then you also have to recognize that the people who make those choices aren't, you know, the children of Obama, Biden, Bush, Mitt Romney. You know, they're the children of people who it really is their only way out. I'll tell you a crazy statistic is over 100 NFL players come from the little scrap of land where Hurricane Katrina hit. That tiny little scrap of land, which
wow.
is so small on a map, over 100 players come from there. And I asked a coach down there why that is, and he said, well, when you have poverty, racism, and year-round sunshine, you have the perfect soil to create professional football players.
That's fascinating. Wow, I had no idea about that. All right, I want to also, now I want to turn to, if you don't mind, talking about this dynamic of stadiums.
Which plays into this. That plays into the previous issue, because this public stadium construction has become a substitute for anything resembling a real urban policy in this country, and has for 15 years. So if you ban the NFL, as bad as it is as economic policy, you would also be eliminating thousands upon thousands of jobs that are working class jobs in cities around the country, because so many cities have now been built around these mega arenas.
Yeah, and you know, and it's also, it's big business. In New York in particular,
oh, yeah.
We've got the Nets now have moved to New York and are going to be playing out of Brooklyn, Atlantic Yards. Very controversial because the way in which developers, well, I'm sure you know this story. Tell us this story about how the Atlantic Yards were developed.
No, absolutely. And, you know, I should be full disclosure here. Like, I was one of the first people to sign on to a group called Develop Don't Destroy Brooklyn, because my family roots are in Brooklyn, and I know what these kinds of stadium construction deals bring. I mean, they bring gentrification. They bring, there's no other word for it, but really ethnic cleansing of entire areas. And Brooklyn has already done enough of that. Just watch the TV show Girls sometimes. I mean, it takes place in
right.
white Brooklyn.
Right, right.
And I think that the Atlantic Yards is really part of that project. Jay-Z, who's the minority owner of the team, is in a lot of ways like a hideous kind of window dressing for the fact that this is something that's actually going to displace poor families.
Well,
poor
literally,
families of color.
I mean, he's in charge of marketing.
Yeah, exactly.
And, which is exactly what window dressing is, right?
That's a very good point.
And
yeah.
I mean, so he's literally that. But
yeah, it started with Bruce Ratner, who's a developer in New York. Interestingly, Bruce Ratner's brother is Michael Ratner, who's a hero among progressives because he does the Center for Constitutional Rights. And mm-hmm. I always find that family connection to be very interesting and very ironic because Michael Ratner has devoted his life to the pursuit of constitutional protections. And you think about why aren't there constitutional protections for people who are literally removed from their homes on these fair use laws and all the rest of it for the purposes of building eminent domain laws, for the purposes of building these stadiums. And hundreds upon hundreds of people were displaced from downtown Brooklyn to be able to create this stadium by Bruce Ratner. It wasn't supposed to just be a stadium, but be this whole urban redevelopment project with condos and all the rest of it, really transforming a good section of Brooklyn, you know, of a Brooklyn that really does not even really exist anymore. I once got in a debate with someone who worked for the Brooklyn Borough President's office, and by the time that it's pretty indefensible what they're doing to Brooklyn residents.
Right.
And so the last refuge of his argument was, well, you have to understand that everything you're talking about with gentrification is already happening anyway. And it's like, you're right. It is already happening anyway. And this is just putting this process on steroids by bringing a stadium in there.
And, you know, in this situation, there was they managed to take that land by eminent domain.
Yes.
By citing the urban blight.
Yes.
That had taken place there. The urban blight was defined as having empty buildings that were
yes.
of no use. And it just so happens that those buildings were empty of no use because the developers of the Atlantic Yards bought them
right.
and left them empty to create the urban
exactly.
blight and allowed them to go in for eminent domain. So this is, you know, sort of at a time where the Occupy movement is, you know, is still out there and talking about the 1%. This couldn't have been a better example of
right.
how the 1% owns government, at least on a local level, and games the system on a federal level.
And Jay-Z trying to come out with his Occupy brand of fashion wear at that time, which then he withdrew from after getting a lot of criticism. This was an example of the profound ironies that exist in our system, given that he was at the tip of the iceberg of what they were doing to Brooklyn. There is the last part of this story, though, which is so important, is that Bruce Ratner, in effect, needed a bailout because there was so much protest against Atlantic Yards that he was running out of the kind of money it would have taken to finally push the project over the finish line, because it's not just about construction, it's about PR and whole operation.
Right.
So he found that bailout in the form of Mikhail Prokhorov, who is worth roughly $18 or $19 billion. He is a classic post-Soviet Russian mafia capitalist, like a classic version of this, in that he was somebody whose family was in charge of a state-owned industry that then became private, and then he magically becomes this multi-billionaire. And he came in to save the project, and he's the person who's bankrolling it. Now, all of this only matters from the perspective of development, from the perspective of creating jobs and all the rest of it, if they can field a team that people are actually willing to go and see. And that's the last part of this, because I have doubts in their ability to even do that, not just because the Nets are so historically awful, but because it's not like with baseball, where, you know, you got to go out to the Bronx, and then there's Queens to see the Yankees and Mets. And I mean, the Knicks are right there on 33rd Street.
Right.
It's a 15-minute subway ride from that part of Brooklyn.
Right.
And I have real doubts about whether New York City can comfortably support two different franchises.
In basketball.
In basketball.
Particularly, I mean, it's
yes.
in basketball.
In basketball, in particular, yes.
And of course, you know, then there's the question of, did it need it? I mean,
right.
because here you have one official on one hand saying, well, gentrification's already happening.
Mm-hmm.
Development's going on. Well, if that's the case, then why do we need to put this huge square cement box in the middle of this where you have housing costs going up already, where you could at least organically and, Brooklyn still, there's gentrification that's going on there, but there's still some type of economic mix of people.
Yes.
And you do not address gentrification by getting rid of the last, you know,
right.
some of the last vestiges of
right.
people who provide some type of social and economic.
Yeah, yeah. The right argument from their side should not be, "Hey, it's happening anyway, so what's the big deal about a stadium?" I'll tell you what a sports economist said to me, which I think says everything about this kind of stadium funding, is he said it makes better economic sense to fly a plane with $1 billion in it and dump it on a city and let people pick up the bills and spend them than it does to use that money to build a stadium.
Well, that's the national story, isn't it?
Yes.
Mean, we could have bailed out the banks by bailing out the people who had borrowed money from the banks,
exactly,
whose mortgages were underwater, and they would have paid off the banks.
Which gets back to our original discussion, because this is why I think sports, I'm glad we're doing a sports panel here at Netroots, and why this discussion is so important, because sports is the closest thing to a national language that we have. And I've found my own experience is that it's a lot easier to talk to people about corporate welfare by talking about sports and stadium constructions instead of by talking about the arcane banking laws.
Indeed.
That led to the bailout. It's a way to have a bigger discussion and should not be ignored by progressives.
Dave Zirin, edgeofsports.com. That's where you can go to read about it and not ignore those issues. And also a frequent writer and contributor to The Nation magazine. And
always great to talk to you, Sam.
Appreciate talking to you, Dave.
Thanks.
That was my interview with Dave Zirin, Edge of Sports. Also, you should check out his book on John Carlos. You can check it out at edgeofsports.com. He actually just tweeted that I was one of the funnest guys to do an interview with in media. Maybe. I don't know who else is edging me out there, but
he just said the maybe part to keep his options open for future interviews.
Right. You got to do that for political reasons. I understand that. Folks, that is our program for today, unless you are a supporter of this program. In other words, what you just got was just a gift from the gods. Every day I take a little piece of me and I give it to you. But soon there may not be anything left. Granted, on Father's Day, I had 2 donuts. That was my big splurge for the week. I used 75 of my Weight Watcher points on Sunday. But you can continue to grow me in mass. In other words, to make sure that I'm able to give you a little piece of me every day by becoming a member. We really honestly do need your memberships. I'm back in that mode now where I'm contemplating a format change so as to encourage you. And I keep threatening to do this. And I've been threatening this for 17 months. But really, do we need to have this type of relationship where I threaten you? Is that the type of relationship that we need to have? Where I threaten you and make you have a timeout or tell you that you can't have dessert this week? Or say that I'm going to take one of your Barbies if you don't behave? No, I don't think you want that. So please, if you can, and only if you can, become a member today just for the sake of the first half of the show. You don't need to get, if you don't want the extra content, don't take it. It's theirs for the choosing. But for $10 a month, you can support this program. Pennies a day, literally pennies a day. Less than your Starbucks. If you buy 2 Starbucks a week, or you buy 5 and cut down to 3. In other words, it's if you enjoy this program, listen to it every day, or even 4 days a week, or 1 day a week, and you want it to continue, please become a member. Majority.fm. Very easy to do. You get swag, if that's what you really need. If you need some free comedy DVDs, we got them. A Bad Situationist, Pilot Season, Who's the Caboose? All that and more. And, of course, there are other ways to support this program. If you buy Amazon crap, buy it through our link. It's still crap. You're still buying all this crap, but we're getting a little bit of a kickback, and you can find that link at majority.fm/support-the-show, or just go to majority.fm at the top of the page. You'll see support the show. Click there. Click on the Amazon button, bookmark that, always buy your crap through that. JustCoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, and chocolate. 10% discount code, majority. Delicious coffee that actually does not exploit anybody in the chain from the moment that it's grown to the moment that you brew it. Unless maybe around your house you are in some way exploited by someone in your house. But I can't control that. You can also give us a review on iTunes. Tomorrow on this program, Rick Perlstein talking about what happened in Wisconsin. And also, there's a couple of questions. I mean, he's the man to ask about Watergate that I want to ask. Because we the 40th anniversary was just this weekend of Watergate. Which will dovetail nicely into our talk with Chris Hayes on Thursday about his book, Twilight of the Elites. Because in 1973 or 4, in the wake of Watergate, he quotes, I think it was the New York Times, in saying, citizenry trust in our institutions is at an all-time low from polling data at that time. Well, that turns out to be the high watermark of citizens' trust in their institutions. 40 years later, it's even much, much worse. So, God, I think of the content that you've gotten this week, and I'm just beside myself that you're not a member. I'm a little bit hurt. I'm talking to you. Yes. And while you're jogging or cleaning or commuting in your car, I'm talking to you. All right, we're going to take a break. We'll head back, come back for the better half of the program, which is available to all supporters of this program. Chris Christie, the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, Trinity Church, Republicans hiding behind kids. This is just a horrible sound. Horribly ridiculous. And speaking of horribly ridiculous, Congressman goes on to argue why kids who are brought here by their parents, and their parents being undocumented aliens, why undocumented immigrants, why those kids really need to buck up. Unbelievable. And then we'll talk about Mitt Romney on the Dream Act. Oh, I got so much here to talk about. We'll be back in just a moment. You can call this program 646-257-3920. You can IM me at Majority FM. And I haven't even mentioned the fact that Jamie Dimon right now is having brunch with his friends in Congress. I mean, ostensibly he's testifying, but from what I can tell, it sounds like he's getting a pedicure. Somebody should check his toenails when he leaves there, because I have a feeling they're going to look wonderful. See you in the better half.